Hello, I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Roger Grimes, data-driven defense evangelist for KnowBefore, the world's first and largest new school security awareness training and simulated phishing platform that helps you manage the ongoing problem of social engineering. To learn more about KnowBefore, visit knowbefore.com. Roger, welcome. So great to have you back with us today.
I'm excited to be here, as always.
So, Roger, the Department of Justice unsealed a criminal complaint earlier this week about a hacker and ransomware designer who was charged for the use and sale of ransomware, as well as profit-sharing arrangements with cybercriminals. And apart from being a hacker and cybercriminal, this man and his name, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing, but his name, Moises Luis Zagala Gonzalez, he's also a cardiologist. So fascinating that a doctor would be turning to cybercrime. So with that, Roger, can you tell us more about this complaint that the Department of Justice has unsealed and, you know, what they're alleging and what's happening in the cyber ecosystem that's causing cardiologists to want to get in on the criminal activity?
Yeah, I tell you, that was probably the most shocking part of the announcement, is that it involved an actual cardiologist. But typically, you would think that guy is not only busy, but making enough money that he doesn't have to do this scam. And let me say, actually not the first doctor, I think, although the first cardiologist that I know of. The first ransomware program, what's called known as the AIDS Cop Trojan in 1989, was actually done by a PhD doctor. He was a different type of doctor, but, you know, always strange when doctors do it, because you figure you should have a good career and good money and not have to do cybercrime on the side. But it was interesting in a lot of ways. What was interesting about the software that he made is he didn't make ransomware per se. He made a ransomware kit that he would sell to other people that would make ransomware. So it was interesting in that way that you would start this program or rent the program, and you would put in the parameters that you wanted this ransomware program to have, and then, you know, hit create essentially, and it would make a ransomware program that then other people that were buying it or renting it could then, you know, spread to victims and collect money. And he not only made that program, and let me say, those sort of kits where you can make things. I remember computer virus kits back in the early 1990s were all the rage, and there's still like phishing kits today. So the idea that you start this program that then creates this other malware program, somewhat customized malware program, those have been around since at least the early 1990s. So that particular part isn't new. It isn't new having the ransomware kits that make other ransomware programs, although he's probably, you know, one of the central figures in that. But yeah, the question is why did a cardiologist, like, you have to feel like this guy's probably not the best cardiologist if he's spending, you know, every free second making malware and stuff like that. But maybe I'm wrong. He could just have been a really incredibly brilliant person. Some people on the Twitter feed about this speculated that Venezuela, where he was living, he's a French citizen living in Venezuela, they have horrific inflation. And when I say horrific, I mean 20,000% in a year isn't an unusual figure there. So can you imagine what, you know, a dollar would buy? Now you'd have to have $20,000 to buy just a year later. And it's that year after year for decades. So some people speculated that even as a cardiologist, he certainly couldn't make enough money. So he's doing these other things, but, you know, it doesn't excuse unethical behavior. He was not only making this ransomware kit, but really central to the government's case is that he was also telling people, encouraging them and telling them how to compromise people. It was interesting too, in his particular case, he was instructing the ransomware spreaders, the affiliates, look around and see if they have any cloud backups. And if they have cloud backups, well, don't worry with them. But if they don't have cloud backups, then they almost always pay. And that was interesting because I do know that ransomware frequently encrypts cloud backups. But I would say I lately for the last year or two been telling people that I am seeing benefits for cloud services and products because, you know, if someone encrypts, let's say your Office 365 emails or something, there's a really, really good chance that Microsoft is going to be able to get your emails back in an unencrypted state. The major cloud service providers are really good at backups. They're better than anybody, any normal on-premises backup person. So as long as the data that was encrypted is something that they back up, you're probably going to be able to do a good recovery, probably in most cases up to a month later for most of the major service providers. So it's interesting that he was telling people, the ransomware spreaders, look around, if they have cloud backups, possibly move on. Although I thought that was premature advice, because lots of ransomware people corrupt and are able to cause havoc with cloud backups. But he was just telling them, hey, move on and go to somebody that doesn't have a cloud backup, because then they always pay. That was his particular thing. So he was arrested for years and probably up to a decade for making this ransomware kit, but in advising people. So a lot of the people that get caught, they say, oh, I didn't know it was going to be used for nefarious purposes, you know, stuff like that. But when you're directly advising multiple people on how to accomplish evil, the government's got a pretty good case for you. Although I got to tell you, I couldn't tell based upon the United States announcement whether they had actually arrested him. They said he was indicted, but I couldn't read whether or not he was arrested. Maybe somebody listening knows, or I'll learn after this recording and broadcast, but I couldn't find out if he was actually arrested. Because part of the problem is, once you identify people, you have to have treaties in place where the other jurisdiction agrees to, you know, get a warrant and arrest somebody and detain them and then extradite them in many cases. And I wasn't sure if he'd been detained yet, but certainly identifying him by name, and he's a cardiologist, and I believe we have fairly good treaties with Venezuela. I think there's a good chance he, you know, the announcement, he was actually detained. But I was kind of surprised, because usually in the government's announcement, they will say that, and he was detained. Overall, though, incredibly interesting. I have to think that most cardiologists are making enough money in their day jobs not to have to create ransomware. It was interesting to see he was instructing people, if you have other ransomware people, if you have a ransomware network under you, so you get his program, you're an affiliate, you buy it or you rent it, but then you create your own ransomware network. He was instructing them, don't let it get too large. You only want 5 or 10 or 20 ransomware people under you, because it becomes too difficult to manage. You know, so it was kind of interesting. He was giving them long, you know, these are lessons learned. You really don't want to spread your network out too big and that sort of stuff. So the whole thing, the more and more I read about it, it was just overly interesting to me, a guy that reads nonstop about ransomware and ransomware creators, that this had a cardiologist and all of his interactions and stuff like that. It was definitely an interesting news event.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like he had quite the pyramid set up like with the people under him, which is interesting. It's like he was coaching them, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, and certainly I would say he's a small bit player. I don't think him or the people under him were stealing billions of dollars or anything. You know, the ransomware hierarchy runs from these bit players, like I think he was, all the way up to professional organizations. Like, you know, there's recently the Conti ransomware. There's a lot of leaks from their email and chat that showed that they literally had something like 60 full-time employees. And then if you put in subcontractors and stuff, it was hundreds and hundreds of people. You know, for the larger ransomware gangs, it's run more like a kind of a loose-knit corporation. Some of them are run like cartels, where you have many different gangs that then come together as a cartel. And then it's all the way down to individuals. And he would fall under the individuals, this lone dude cardiologist that was doing it. So, and it's just interesting for the motivations. And I don't know, some people again were saying, oh, the inflation was so bad in Venezuela, that's why I did it. Well, you know, there's a lot of inflation in a lot of countries, and most people aren't turning to illegal crime, right? You're just a broken individual when you decide, oh, the only thing I can do is do this illegal thing.
Right, right. And quickly, I'm just thinking, is there a way to track any of his transactions with the people that bought from him, the kit, or is that not possible?
When you arrest the major people, there's a good chance that that guy is going to take a plea bargain. He can plead not guilty, but more than likely he's going to take a plea bargain. And anytime you do a plea bargain, part of that plea bargain always is that you're going to tell them everything you know. And if you don't tell them everything you know, you're holding back information. Or if you lie, then your plea bargain's taken away, and the court system and the judges typically give you the maximum penalty. So anybody that did business with him, you know, they have to be shaking a little bit, because, you know, obviously this guy is going, if he does a plea bargain, is going to turn over all this information. and records, whatever they may be. And, you know, that's usually the first arrest starts a cascading of a lot of other events, because I'm sure not only is he going to turn over the people that he sold the ransomware to, but he's going to be giving them details of how he participated in these criminal auction houses. You know, like a lot of the crimeware and stuff is advertised in these online criminal forums, often hosted in Russia. And, you know, he's going to start to tell them what he knows. And again, if he withholds or lies, the plea deal will go bad and he gets maximum penalty. So one arrest is likely going to lead to other arrests. And there's got to be anybody that's dealt with him, hired him, allowed him to advertise on their form and become friends with him. They all have to be a little bit, you know, scared today. Unfortunately, you know, like if they're in Russia, you're not going to be able to touch those people. That's the problem with all of this. It usually happens across country jurisdictional boundaries, oftentimes between countries that don't accept each other's warrants and jurisdiction and evidence and arrest warrants and stuff. So even if we can identify them, there's nothing we can do. You know, Russia is a cyber criminal safe haven as long as you're paying the bribes to the Russian officials, as is, again, many other places. You know, like I was even watching, it's not on our topics today, but Mark Rober, you know, he's always attacking these spammers, these fake telemarketers. A lot of them initiate out of India. And he's talking about, we know where they operate. We know who the owners are, but we can't touch them. Even when he's reported them to the local Indian police in India, they don't do anything because obviously they're taking bribes. And that's part of the problem. Even if you can identify people, even if you have the evidence, even if you notify law enforcement, well, good luck, because law enforcement is often on the take.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks for talking us through that, Department of Justice alleging. Looking forward to the next topic I want to talk to you about, which is I read an article that was published in the Hacker News about how researchers found a potential way to run malware on an iPhone, even when it's shut off. Now, I don't know about anyone else, and I'm sure there are many, many people listening who are much smarter than me, so I apologize. But for me personally, my fail-safe whenever there's something funky happening to one of my devices is to shut it off, power it down, what have you. So that doesn't seem like it's going to work so much longer. So I guess tell us about this, Roger, and what this means for us in the future.
Yeah, this is an interesting attack. Again, what they found out is that when you turn off your iPhone, and I don't know how much this applies to Android, but I would assume this applies to all cell phones or most cell phones, but on iPhones in this particular study, when you turn off your iPhone, there really is still some chips, some part of it that's activated. And I think we've known for a long time that even when your cell phone is off, that it's really still pinging the towers. For decades, criminals have turned off their cell phone only to learn that the cops are still able to track their pings, triangulate their pings and go, oh, your phone was pinging within a quarter mile of where the murder victim was found. And so criminals today are smart enough, well, some of them, I guess, at least, not to bring the cell phones along or to use burner cell phones. Well, so it turns out for a long time, a lot of cell phones, most cell phones, when you turn them off, they're still energized and providing information. At the very least, they're providing, again, these pings and pinging off the cell tower. iPhones in particular, though, have this Find My Device, Find My iPhone feature. So, oh, I've lost my cell phone. Someone's stolen my iPhone. You know, we all know the great YouTube stories of people tracking down people that have stolen their iPhones, like TSA steals their iPhone and they're showing up at the TSA person's house. And so what the researchers found is that they could insert malware into the firmware that controls those devices and chips. And I got to say, that's not super surprising to me. There's lots of firmware attacks. And, you know, the NSA leaks show that, you know, our government and probably most nation states have lots of ability to modify firmware than to have it do things. This is a new example of that and was interesting in that, you know, he was saying we could modify the firmware in such a way to place malware that would then do something nebulous. It's interesting. It's not unique. It's been done before. It's been done before on cell phones. It's been done on Android phones, iPhones. But, you know, I do think this is certainly a wake-up call for people that think their phone turned off is really off.
Me.
You know, and it isn't really off. And the police and law enforcement and Apple and everybody nobody wants you to know that it's really still doing something when it's powered down, you know, until it literally loses power. Once your battery is completely dead, then those things typically don't work anymore. Or you could put it inside of a Mylar bag or something like that if you don't want it tracked or something like that. But off is not necessarily off. And that's even the same thing for computers. You know, we have the feature called Wake on LAN on most computers today, where somebody can remotely turn on your PC. So you've turned your PC off and then you can hit it with a wake on LAN packet. And this was instituted for a lot of reasons, but mostly for patching so that people inside of a enterprise could say, oh, this new Chrome patch is coming. Everybody's got to get patched, but everybody's turning off their PCs. Everybody's PCs were being powered down to be green and save electricity. You know, by default, when you buy any device today, after 15, 20 minutes of inactivity, it powers it down. Well, it really doesn't shut off everything. Matter of fact, usually it's keeping the memory energized in the CPU. And the only way they can do that is to keep things energized, to keep your memory chips and CPU energized. And then the wake on LAN chip is always there. So an administrator can tell the wake on LAN chip, wake it up so I can patch it, you know, that sort of thing. So most devices today that we use, when you power them down and you think they're down, they're really still some portion of them being up. And let me say, nation states have used these attack vectors for years, where they modify the firmware to then place malware. So really, the threat isn't so much that you have some chip and firmware or memory or CPU that's still activated when you think you've powered it off. That really is as designed, and people actually want those features. They want to know when they've lost their iPhone or when someone's stolen their iPhone and be able to track it. But the question is Apple going to put in place integrity checks so that their firmware, in this case involved in this particular attack, you know, isn't modified maliciously? So you're like, hey, it's all right to be able to update firmware, but it should be updated by the authorized vendor and that sort of thing. Apple needs to, I'm sure, calm people down a little bit and say, don't freak out. Every device is like this today. But also reassure them that we're going to do some integrity checks to make it harder for someone to maliciously manipulate firmware in an unauthorized manner. And on PCs, they use something called a Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. So PCs went from BIOSes to UEFI, again, Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. And that whole idea was, hey, we're going to protect firmware so it can't be modified unless it's an authorized update or patch. And even occasionally that gets hacked, but at least they're trying. Well, we need the same thing on all devices, including phones, including iPhones, that says, hey, don't allow malicious updates. You know, even when you try to prevent malicious updates, you're still going to have hackers that are able to do it, but at least you're putting in integrity and defense software that tries to make sure that it's not so easy, as this last attack showed from the researchers that it's really easy to do. Well, Apple needs to respond and make it less easy to do.
That's interesting. Is it advantageous for Apple to not have already created something like that? Or is it just something they probably overlooked? I guess I'm just thinking about why wouldn't they have started down that path before all of this?
I'm sure they considered it, and I'm sure there's multiple mechanisms they have in place to prevent unauthorized malware modification of firmware, but obviously this person circumvented it, and it's certainly not as strong as it needs to be. Apple iPhones are just continually targeted by nation states. There literally are dozens of companies around the world that all they do is break into iPhones for their customers. And it's not just nation states, it's almost anyone that they will sell their software to. And they sell their software to thousands of customers. And so Apple needs to make it tougher to do. I don't think they didn't do anything. I'm sure that when they planned and put stuff up, they made checks. But obviously their checks aren't strong enough and they need to take it more seriously. And then also, maybe on the other note, people need to understand that their devices are always active and can be tracked. And, you know, just at least understand that you're living with that consequence that your device is always on. Even if they prevent malicious modification, there's things like, you know, the Apple trackers and things like that. Just, you know, we're in a really weird place in the world right now where your privacy is being invaded more than ever. And there's lots of people that know where you physically are. And they can do things like, you know, in the past, they've done things like turn on people's microphones. I'm sure people's iPhones and Android microphones are being turned on all the time so nation states and other people can spy on people. And again, that requires a malicious software update and or firmware update. And it's done all the time intentionally. And there's dozens of companies, that's their day job, is breaking into your phone and doing this sort of stuff. And again, Apple and Android manufacturers just need to do a better and better job of preventing these malicious modifications. Because all of us, we're buying our phones, we're not thinking, wow, I'm buying these phones so the vendor can do kind of an okay job in trying to prevent this, but not really preventing this. We definitely need to force the vendor to do a better job.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're talking about the phone staying on, it just makes me think of how far we've come since the days when you could simply remove the battery of your phone too. I remember having to do that to reset my cell phone back in the day, and it's just, you can't even get in there. I don't even know, you know, I don't have the tools to do that anymore, especially not on my Apple Watch or things like that. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that was more of a marketing thing versus a spying thing. If you can change out the battery, you keep that phone longer. So by making it impossible for you to replace that battery, it means you're updating sooner. That was just a marketing decision. Like, light bulbs are intentionally made not to last as long anymore. And it literally was a cartel to make them last less long. Same thing with the phones, right? All the phone manufacturers don't want you being able to replace the battery, because that's what, you know, over time, your battery will always, from the first day you get it, always start losing its ability to produce power. And that is, you know, built-in obsolescence. You're not going to be able to run your iPhone for 10 years for very long without charging it twice a day. And that's what they want. They don't want you to have the ability just to replace the battery. You wouldn't buy the latest model. So all of it's interesting and sad for the consumer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, Roger, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. And I just really enjoyed being back with you. And these were great topics. You just were so wonderful to speak with. So thank you for taking the time.
You too, Hillary. Back at you. And thank you for a wonderful discussion again.
I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Roger Grimes, Data-Driven Defense Evangelist for KnowBefore, the world's first and largest new school security awareness training and simulated phishing platform that helps you manage the ongoing problem of social engineering. To learn more about our sponsor, KnowBefore, visit KnowBefore.com. And you can keep up with all of our media at CybercrimeMagazine.com.